Neil McCabe, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Great to be with you, Ron.
So, to start off, give us a brief bio, if you will, about Charles Conlon.
Charles M. Conlon was a newspaper proofreader, a printer, typesetter, and he was not a professional photographer. But one day his editor at the New York Telegram said, "Hey, Charlie, I know you take pictures. How about going to the polo grounds and taking some photographs?" And that's how it started. He was a... Go ahead.
And this was when?
This was 1904. Yeah, I forgot about that. He was taking pictures of, like, his cats and landscapes and fountains. And the guy said, "I need pictures of the ball players." He was John Foster, who was working at the Spalding Guide. And most of the pictures of the ball players were studio shots. And he said, "Go out in the field and take pictures." So the first picture he ever took was Christy Mathewson out in the parking lot, or the carriage park, as it was called in those days. And it's one of the most famous pictures ever taken. So this hobbyist immediately became one of the best baseball photographers ever.
What kind of equipment did he use?
He used glass negatives, and it was a bulky camera. And it wasn't really made for carrying around, but it was called a Graflex camera. But one advantage it had was he also took some of the first action shots. It was the films, or I should say the photographic plates were getting faster and faster. So he took, the most famous baseball action shot ever, almost by accident in 1910, Ty Cobb sliding into third base. So he was the right man at the right time.
And
he never quit his day job, though. He was never a professional photographer. He was doing this on the side, completely.
And where would he situate himself for the action shots?
Usually he'd be by the coach's box, either first base or third base. But his best shots were by third base. And, of course, he prepared for the shot. He knew how to, he focused on the bag. And he waited for the runner to slide. And he always thought that was the most interesting aspect of his oeuvre, shall we say, were the action shots. But as I discovered, the best shots, his most lasting pictures, are the portraits. And that's what you really see in his work, how beautiful his portraits are.
Now just for the listeners to be clear, in these days, the photographers were on the field. There were no photographers' wells. So they were, like, right there on the action.
And he talks about it. One day, a guy named John Titus hit the ball and hit him in the ankle, and in 30 years later, he said it still hurts. They eventually got the photographers off the field. They made a ruling in 1910 because so many photographers were getting, you know, knocked over and injured. So, he'd see guys carried off the field, photographers. And then they brought them back. You see a lot of newsreel footage back in the 30s and 40s. They were back on the field, but eventually, you know, they had to say, "Get off of there. One of you guys is going to get killed."
Mm-hmm. And we're seeing that a few years back when Mike Coolbaugh was unfortunately killed with the line drive. And,
No, it's a dangerous job. You're sitting right there by the dugout, and you're not paying attention specifically to the ball. Yeah, it's deadly.
So over the course of his career, which lasted how long?
He started in 1904, and his last photographs were 1942, which means the baseball guides were ending. World War II was happening, and baseball guides ended. So he was an old man, too, so he just retired. So it was 39 seasons he took pictures.
And is there any sense of how many photographs he took over that time?
Well, it's hard to say because so many of them are lost to us. He never really, you know, saved all of them. I'd say a minimum of 30 to 40,000 pictures.
Wow.
He could have taken as many as 60 or 70,000 because he took a lot of pictures that we'll never know about.
Now you say a lot of the plates were lost or destroyed. How did
By him. He says they were running me out of the house. So but think about it. Back in the 30s, nobody cared about pictures of some guy from 1911 or 1907. This is ephemera. This is stuff you don't need anymore. So he just said, well, I won't need. He destroyed them.
Wow.
And somebody at the Sporting News who printed that interview said, hey, I'm sure they said, hey, Charlie, we'll take them. Don't worry about it. Whatever you. So they ended up with 8,000 plus glass, mainly glass negatives.
Now,
thank God.
To describe exactly what a glass negative is, how big it is.
Well, in the early years, they're 5x7, like about the size of a paperback book, a standard pocketbook. And then he went to smaller. They're like 4x5 glass negatives. And then by the 30s, he was using film. And that's why this all came about, this whole project, because the Sporting News had these original negatives, and by the 1980s, they were the original nitrate film negatives. These were 4x5 negatives. They were starting to disintegrate. You know, nitrate film will eventually spontaneously combust, which is not good. So she was hired. She's a photo expert. She worked at the National Gallery of Art. She had a consulting thing, and then they said they found out about her, and they said, "Can you help us preserve these negatives?" So she was hired by them to make duplicates so they could retire the original negatives. And of course, glass negatives are very fragile too because it's emulsion coating glass, and it'll eventually flake off. And these negatives, even then, were like 80 or 90 years old. Now they're over 100 years old. So it had nothing to do with me at all. I was 3,000. She's working in Washington, D.C. I'm on the West Coast in L.A. I was minding my own business.
So how did this book project, this book, The Big Show, is the second of the two volumes of photographs by Conlin. Now, how did this project come about?
Well, in my mind, this is always part of the first book. My sister called me up one day and said, I've got these great photographs from the original negatives, all baseball photos taken by one guy. She knew when I was growing up, I was a little baseball geek. I was a fanatic. And I said, well, what do you know about baseball? I totally blew her off. She said, well, but this guy, I'm telling you, these pictures are great. And it's just, I said, well, who took them? They're all one guy. Who is this guy? She said, his name is Charles M. Conlin. I said, I've never heard of him. In my defense, Ron, I must say, no one had ever heard of Charles M. Conlin, so I don't feel too bad. So I said, you know, forget about it. Finally, she gave me a big packet of her reject prints. She was doing a project. She ended up doing the baseball, Conlin collection, the baseball cards. She was doing that for them, too. And I looked at these pictures she gave me, and I just, you know, I'm surprised I didn't faint. I said, you know how famous these are? These are in every book you ever see, and this Cobb sliding into third. And she said, that's what I've been trying to tell you. So she was right, I was wrong.
So these are photos that fans of the game will recognize immediately, but you never think about the people who actually took the pictures.
Well, and if you think about it, when was the last time you saw a photo credit for the only time I started looking into this. How come I've never heard of this guy? And the only book where I ever saw it credited was Fred Leib's books. He would credit Charles M. Conlin because he knew Conlin. He wrote his obituary for the Sporting News in 1945 when he finally died. But other than that, Conlin never cared about getting credit for his pictures. He would sell them to the Sporting News for a pittance, I'm sure, and they were used by photo agencies, and then he was the staff photographer for Baseball Magazine for like 20 years. So his pictures, if you were a baseball fan, you didn't didn't just see his pictures. You probably owned his pictures because you could send away for them. You know, Dizzy Dean and his brother, you can buy their picture. It was a Colin photo. So he was everywhere. And I had grown up in the 60s, and, of course, his pictures are the glory of their times. You know, Jimmy Austin is the guy that Ty Cobb is knocking over in the famous picture. And he says, see that picture? That's a famous picture. That's me. Mm-hmm. He was proud of it. It's a Colin photo, but nobody knew. And, okay, it's one thing to take a few famous pictures. He took hundreds of famous pictures, and nobody knew it. And here we had the original negatives. It was, you know, talk about something falling into your lap. There it was.
So how did you make your selections for the books?
Well, first of all, some of it was dictated by circumstance. There were large gaps in the collection because of the missing negatives. It was purely by gut instinct. You know, well, first of all, I looked for the famous players. There's Babe Ruth. But, on the other hand, some of the best pictures were players I had never heard of. But I said, well, he's in the book. That's a classic photograph. Who is that guy? So I had to find out who he was. And these were some guys that no one's ever heard of, unless you've read their name in a list somewhere. But here's an example. This is a good example of, okay, one of the things Colin did, he took pictures in 1927 of the New York Yankees starting lineup, Murderers Row, which is really interesting because he took extreme close-ups. He was actually, he titled them eyes. He was going for their eyes. But in the process, he has really tight close-ups. They're astonishing pictures. And I said, well, this will be a fold-out. I had them laid out across my living room floor. I said, this is perfect.
And this is for the first book, Baseball's Golden
Age. First book. Well, the whole book is all one together. So I said to my sister, okay, here, this is the list of photos here, and she called me back and said, well, yeah, I can do something with all those photos, but there's one that it's just not going to work. We can't use it. I said, which one is that? She said, Babe Ruth. The Babe Ruth photo's no good. The negative is too damaged. I said, pardon me? We can't have Murderers Row without Babe Ruth. I don't care what you have to do. I don't care how bad you think it looks. We got to use it. Well, to show you how great she is at what she does, they put it on the back cover. That's how beautiful it looks. You'd never know that there was any damage, but with her high standards, she didn't think it was even usable. So that's the kind of stuff we went through, you know.
Now, what was the division of labor here between the two of you?
Well, she discovered him. She was the one who said, hey, there's something going on here that nobody knows about. She chose the cover photograph, for example, and which is a great choice. It's almost... I always considered this, you asked how I chose the photos, I considered it a Dada art project, meaning like guys like Man Ray in the 20s and André Breton would wrench a photograph out of its context, and all of a sudden it looked really strange. So my sister, she didn't really care who was holding the ball or why. She just looked at this image and said, isn't this beautiful?
Mm-hmm.
So it was almost, Colin took it as almost an industrial photograph, showing a pitcher's hand like the... employing the tools of his trade. In this case, it was his spitball. And I said, you're right. She said, this is our poster. I said, you got it. So that's why this book was kind of original, because we're just coming out of left field with this. She wasn't thinking like a baseball author. She was thinking of it as a photo person. So her job was to take the original negatives and print them. I did everything else, like choose the photographs, pair them, sequence them, research them, and write the captions. But without my sister, there's no book, because she found the guy. And without the Charles M. Colin, they're blank pages. So I'm responsible for like a third of the effort here.
Now, well, one of the really beautiful characteristics of these books is you'll have a player in early on in his career, and then you'll have the same player a dozen years later or so, almost in the same pose, and you see the passage of time, which is really startling.
My sister discovered that phenomenon because she was doing her, you know, doing her job. It could have been pictures of flowers or something, but it happened to be pictures of baseball players. And their sequence, Colin had them sequenced. The first picture he took of, say, Charlie Gehringer was number one, and then number two, et cetera. And by 1934, he'd maybe taking his 14th picture. So I said to my sister, So she noticed while she was printing them in the darkroom that these guys were literally aging before your eyes. The most outrageous example, Roger Angel talks about it in the introduction to the new edition, is Al Simmons. In 1924, he's a baby-faced kid, innocent looking. 15 years later, in 1939, he's an old man. And it's astounding, the change in this guy's face. And actually, no one ever noticed this, so I'll tell you. You'd appreciate it. I actually paraphrased George Orwell. I said, at the age of 39, every ball player has the face he deserves. And, of course, Al Simmons was a notoriously cranky kind of a jerk. And he was looking pretty depressed. And, well, he should have.
And what about the players? How do they feel about being photographed like this?
Well, I actually wrote to some of these guys, and a lot of them had no memory of Charles M. Conlon, because he obviously was just some photographer, and to them he was some old man who was taking their picture. They said he was a gentleman. Al Lopez and somebody else said, Billy Rogel said he was a nice guy. I think he was very unobtrusive. He said, I'm taking your picture for Baseball Magazine or the Spalding Guide. And some of them loved having their picture taken, and it's apparent. You know?
Yeah, there you go.
And there's one guy in there that it's in the second book, The Big Show. It's a guy named Sterling Stryker, and he literally it looks like he's trying to escape the camera. He's turning aside, and I said, okay, that's in the book. Now I've got to find out, why is this guy so unhappy? And I found out, you know, one of the quotes I found in the Library of Congress in an obscure Springfield, Massachusetts paper, the writer starts out, Sterling Stryker has a grievance. And I said, nah, that's in the book. Because it illuminates the picture. See, that was the thing I was trying to do. See, most baseball captions are so lame and so unimaginative and so lazy. You know, it's like he had 11 doubles in 1923 and he struck out 45 times. Who cares? You can look that up. But what I wanted to know is, for example, I have a guy named Poncho Snyder, who I had this picture for the first book, and I said, no, I'm not doing him justice. This is one of the best pictures. And I said, why does this guy look like he's going to kill somebody? And it turns out, I found out, and it's in the caption, his own teammates were frightened of him because he was such a scary guy. He carried knives and guns around, and he says, well, the Sporting News wrote about him. He comes from the country where they make no apologies. You know, they just carve into the handle of their gun another notch. And I said, but here's the thing. Here's what made the book fun to do, and I think it's a good book, is because I didn't just say, yeah, he hit a home run in the 1922 series or whatever he did. I said, this is a scary dude, and Conlon captured this in the picture. And then on the opposite page, I might have I have another guy who had like 50 guns, and he'd be shooting guns out of their cars when he was a rookie. And he said, "There's no guns are like whiskey and dynamite. There's no danger if you know how to use them." And he later became a Texas Ranger, a law enforcement officer. So he said, "I wish I was with I should have been with the pioneers, Lewis and Clark." So then I turned the page, and it's thematically arranged sometimes just the photos work well together. On the next page, I have a guy named Kent Greenfield, and he's another guy I had in the first book, but I said, I got to save it because I don't quite have what I need to say. And it's one of the saddest pictures you've ever seen. And I knew this picture was going to be in the book, but if you look at his stats, or if you go to his very meager Hall of Fame file, he's not interesting at all. But Conlon captured something that literally haunted me. I'd be thinking about this photograph and saying, how am I going to get that in there? There's nothing to say. Finally, I found out when he was a little kid, he used to go in the woods and Guthrie, Kentucky, and a little friend of his would follow him along, and Kent Greenfield would show him up the forest. He was a gifted outdoorsman, and his little friend later wrote about him. He said he should have been with Lewis and Clark, you know, which I related it to the previous caption, but it comes naturally. Well, his little friend who wrote about him grew up to be Robert Penn Warren, the first U.S. poet laureate, the author of All the King's Men, and he wrote poems about Kent Greenfield. He worshipped him. He was his idol. And I found all this out because it's there in the photograph. It was up to me to figure out who is this guy. So that was the fun I had. That was the work. In other words, you can tell I did a lot of work on these captions, and that's one of the cool things about Roger Angel. He said, "Hey, you know, these captions are pretty good." So it's an unexplored art form, I think.
Well, to be fair, they're more than just captions. They're like, I won't go as far as say mini biographies, but you know, it's not the standard 2-line caption. These go into the depth and almost soul of these guys.
They're little essays, I would
right.
say. Yeah, little. That's what I mean. And the other thing, my sister was saying in the first book, and both books are, it's a companion volume. Here's the thing, she would say, "Are you sure you know what you're doing?" And I said, "Trust me, print the pictures, I got it covered." When the first book, I submitted it to the publisher, we submitted it, I said, "Okay, it will be 375 photographs." That was the minimum I had in mind. And they said, "You want to bet?" They said, "It's going to be 200, because we're not going to print a paving stone here. It's got to be imaginable, manageable-sized book." So that was my problem. I had so many great photographs, but in the end, I said, "You know what? There's volume two. It's going to happen." Problem was, things went wrong. People say there's an 18-year gap between the books, and they say, "Well, what's up with that?" And it all has to do with like a, kind of a prolonged, I don't know, like a divorce, because the Sporting News had the rights to the pictures and they didn't want to give it to us. It's like a custody battle. So it's one of those things. It had nothing to do with the book. It had to do with the contracts and rights and stuff. Finally, the Sporting News was celebrating its 125th anniversary, and I said, "Hey, what do you think we put this out?" And they go, "Yeah, that sounds good." So all of a sudden, all of this, the conflict disappeared, and the book came out. So I would say to any, well, exactly, well, thank God, because for a long time there was kind of discouraging, but it came out. And it was fun because I said to the editor-in-chief, I said, "Hey, how about you reissue the first book because it's as a companion volume in the same format?" And he went, "Yeah, sounds good." So in the end, everything was very simple, and they gave me a really good editor who was extremely helpful, and it worked out.
So this is it? There's no third volume coming?
Well, if you had all of the Conlon photographs that he ever published, you could do 10 volumes.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, that will not be. So, I'm done with baseball books.
Switching gears for a second from the visual to the oral, you also worked on the audio version of The Glory of Their Times. What was that like?
It was a thrill, to put it mildly. The first fan letter we got from Baseball's Golden Age, the first book, in 1993, the publisher forwards you letters. I guess nowadays people will just email you, but back then they forwarded a letter. The first, and this is true, and I couldn't believe it, the first letter I got as a fan letter was from some guy named Lawrence S. Ritter, the author. It's like if you're if you're a songwriter and you get a fan letter from George Gershwin or something, you know, it's like, whoa. So, of course, I immediately wrote him back. He loved the book because, of course, I was influenced by The Glory of Their Times. Who wasn't? And I looked. The first thing I did was look for all the Glory guys, and I found some. That's why I put Jimmy Austin in there, the guy in the Ty Cobb photo, and other players. And he said, "Yeah, I knew Chief Myers," as if I didn't know. You know, he's a very humble guy, so we corresponded. And to make a long story short, the only book signing we did for that book, my sister arranged it in Washington D.C. And we're sitting there, and I'm kind of bored, and some guy walks up and says, "Hey, I see you've got Walter Johnson in that book." And I go, "Oh, yeah, I know a lot about Walter Johnson." I started spouting off the few things I knew about Walter Johnson. And he goes, yeah, he was my grandfather. Kind of a humiliating moment, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
But he turned out to be a really nice guy, and his name is Henry W. Thomas. And he said, "Hey, you want to I got, you want to see Walter's baseball from the game-winning ball of the 1924 World Series and Walter's scrapbooks? I said, yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing it. So we became, if I have to. So, of course, he took me to see them. And I met his mom, who is Walter's daughter, who's still a friend of mine. She's almost 90. Her name is Carolyn. And she's a very bookish person. She was reading a book when I met her. She's a sweetheart. So anyway, at one point the conversation came to Ritter, and I had met him. I invited myself to Ritter's. I said, "Hey, I'm going to be in New York." By the way, I was checking out the date of the Charles M. Conlon slide photo with Ty Cobb. I found the date through various clues and photographs. July 23rd, 1910. A little side note here. You think that's an amazing photograph. Well, it is, because Ty Cobb walked on four pitches with nobody on base, stole second on the next pitch, stole third on the next pitch, and went home on the catcher's overthrow, which is why the third baseman is looking so awkward. It is the greatest base runner of his era at his absolute peak. So it's there in the photograph once again. Conlon caught it.
And for him to catch it in those circumstances like that, I mean, we're not talking digital photography here where you just press a button and you're done.
Oh, no. In fact, you look at the original negative, which miraculously survived. Somebody put it in the vault, and they thought they had lost it. Well, actually, somebody had wisely stored it away carefully. But my sister had to restore the negative because there was a crack running through the negative. So, that's the kind of stuff my sister can repair. Those are unbelievably fragile things. So, if you look at the original negative, Conlon barely caught the picture. He was prepared for the photograph, but Cobb arrived there. I mean, he had just been at the plate like 30 seconds earlier, and nobody, and his camera was tilted sideways, and you can see that he was juggling the camera. And afterwards, he said, "I wasn't sure I even got it because it happened so suddenly."
That's right. You wouldn't know you have it until you actually go and develop it.
Yeah. It could be blurred. You could have gotten the wrong moment. It could have been after the moment. He went home and here's what's interesting. Here's an example of Conlon. Okay, it was taken July 23rd, 1910. And it was published? Well, he worked for a newspaper, but he wasn't their sports photographer. They had sports photographers. So he took it home and stored it away. It was first published a year and a half later in one of the guides. Even he didn't value what he did that much. It wasn't like timeliness was a virtue of any kind. So anyway, so I went to New York to finally nail down the Conlon photo, and I said, "Hey, Larry, you want to get together?" So we got together, and it was shortly after the Ken Burns documentary had aired, and I said, "I noticed they had people reading from the Glory of Their Times, actors." And he said, "Yeah, that kind of disappointed me, because he could have used the original tapes if he wanted to." And I went, "Huh, wow, so the original tapes are still there?" And then on the same trip, I went to Cooperstown, and they were opening a new improved library, and they were giving me a tour. And I noticed on these library carts, they had a tape boxes. And I looked at them, and I said, "Is that what I think it is?" And they said, "Yeah, those are the Ritter's original Glory of Their Times tapes, reel-to-reel tapes." I said, "Wow, that's pretty amazing." So I talked to Henry W. Thomas, and he, of course, is a big fan of the Glory of Their Times because his grandfather is one of the main featured guys, Walter Johnson. Sam Crawford says, "Yeah, they got a great big apple knocker going against you guys today." Sam Crawford faced Johnson in his first game, and he talks about it. And Henry Thomas does a killer imitation of it. And he said, "Ask Ritter, whatever happened to those tapes? Why have they never come out as a disc, a box set or something?" So I asked him, and Ritter said, "No one's ever asked." And I said,
"I'm asking.
We're going for it." And he said, "Yeah, but, you guys don't know what you're getting into." And he said it was incredibly time-consuming, and he mimed pulling out some tape and cutting it with a razor and then listening. And he said, "You guys, you have no idea what you're getting into." I said, "Yeah, but the tapes are so great." I said, "Fred Snodgrass, fabulous. He said, because there had been a record that had come out that he had produced. That's how he, in the 60s. And he said, yeah, but it was unbelievable. I had to cut out all the interruptions and the noise. And I said, let us worry about it. Well, we did it, and we did a great job. It was incredibly time-consuming, though. He was right about that. But thank God we had digital, so we could do the noise reduction, because there were, like, Goose Goslin's motorboats, and he ran a motorboat rental thing, and all sorts of clocks and air conditioners, and Lefty O'Doul's restaurant. You listen to the original tape, and it's, like, unbelievably noisy. The dishes are clinking, and silverware is clattering, and the delivery trucks are... But thanks to digital... In other words, 5 years earlier, we couldn't have done it. It would have been impossible. With digital, though, and noise reduction, all of a sudden, you know he's in a restaurant, but it's kind of charming. You know, it's little noises that you'd expect. And you get to listen to Larry Ritter, and you realize how important Larry Ritter was to that project, because a lot of people imitated him. In fact, I said to him once, because people started, I wouldn't say ripping us off, but imitating what we had done, format identical and all that. I said, man, they're copying us, Larry. And he goes, hey, when you do something good, people are going to copy you. Get used to it. Because he, of course, no one has been copied more than the Glory of the Tons and Ritter's work. So, but it was kind of funny, though. He himself, it turns out, he's a really nice guy, but this was his baby, obviously. And he let us do whatever we want. He gave us carte blanche. And we respected that. We knew how important his work was. So we did our best, and we did a good job, I think. But he was very upset with me. I designed the package that I didn't use the original photos from the book. And I said, Larry, everybody's got your book. They know. I wanted to, like, compliment your book. And also the last photo is the same, which is kind of a wink to the book. He didn't like that particularly. But then he didn't like the fact that we didn't use all the players from the book. But we had a problem. In the book, they're great, but on tape, it's a different thing entirely.
Right.
For example, Paul Wainer, I think, was one of his favorites, and we didn't use Paul Wainer because we just listened to it, and he doesn't come across. I think it's one of those things, you had to be there. Whereas Fred Snodgrass, fantastic. And Lefty O'Doul, I mean, he's like the most outgoing, funny guy you've ever heard. And then one guy, though, and this was kind of unfortunate, one guy in the tape, Henry and I just loved him, Jimmy Austin. Unfortunately, Jimmy had false teeth, and they didn't fit perfectly. But his charm and his love of life and his laugh is so fantastic. Unfortunately, Ritter didn't like, he basically gave the project thumbs down because of Jimmy Austin. And you understand, it's his the glory of their times. But we basically said, you know, Larry, on this one we're right, you're wrong. And we became somewhat estranged at this point. It was very, but there's a kind of a bittersweet ending. In fact, we visited him, and he hadn't even opened up the set. He hadn't even looked at it. So, but fortunately later, a reporter for the New York Times wrote a story about the audio set. He had been in his car, and the player that he fell in love with was, who else? Jimmy Austin. And he later wrote a story, and here's Ritter was kind of in his declining years. He sought Ritter out to talk about Ritter and the audio set. So the thing is, we were right, and I talked to Ritter, and we kind of made up and everything, but on the other hand, you've got to do what you know is right, and we were justified. I mean, we did the only thing we could do, but it gets complicated, you know. Mm. But we respected the glory of their times, and so anyway, with these two books, the reason you're talking to me, the Big Show, the Glory of Their Times, and Baseball's Golden Age. Now I've done three classics, so. I'm kind of spoiled at this point. But I had a little help from guys named Larry Ritter and Charlie Conlon. So I'm not particularly, it keeps me humble, because without those guys, I've done nothing. So.
And we have been talking with Neil McCabe, who with his sister Constance McCabe has produced these two wonderful books, The Big Show, Charles Conlon's Golden Age Baseball Photography, and Baseball's Golden Age, The Photographs of Charles M. Conlon. Neil, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Ron.
And that wraps up another edition, another podcast edition of the Baseball Bookshelf. Our next guest will be Rabbi Rebecca Alpert, author of Out of Left Field, Jews and Black Baseball. I had a chance to talk with the rabbi during a very interesting three-day program on Judaism and baseball hosted at the Isabella Friedman Jewish Retreat Center in Connecticut. And we'll be putting up other items from that conference as well. There were many authors there and very interesting topics of discussion. I'll be going on vacation for a brief bit, but when I return, I'll be looking forward to getting back to work on the edits for my forthcoming book, 501 Titles the Baseball Fan Must Read Before They Die. And remember, we love your comments, questions, and feedback, so please send us an email at our new address, ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com. That's ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf, all one word, no punctuation. So, I hope you're enjoying your summer, everybody. Thanks for listening, and talk to you again soon.